Network, this is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
I'm Tom Rowe, Ian Aker, and you've tuned into the WGXC Morning Show. Today on the WGXC Morning Show, we will hear about local artist Isadora Fernandez and how she uses industrial pollutants and microplastics in her work. We'll also hear from Jerry Condon about the Golden Rule Veterans Peace Boat that left Catskill this morning for Albany. And we'll hear from Pete Sikora, the Climate and Equality Campaigns Director at New York Communities for Change, about what the state government is or isn't doing to combat climate actions locally that we've seen recently, including smoke from distant fires and intense flooding. Plus, we'll hear the national headlines from the Public News Service and local better weather from the Catskill Maker Syndicate. It all starts after the local news on the WGXC Morning Show. Stay tuned.
This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news.
This is Mitch Easter of Sneakers, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Accra.
You can find out about so many local events, like the traditional Irish music session. Every Sunday, there's an open Irish music jam at the Shamrock House in East Durham from 2 to 5 p.m. Find out more on the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org and add your own event to the WGXC community calendar and have it read on the radio at 90.7 FM by going to WGXC.org and clicking on the community calendar.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Marxists of Ghent, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org and click Donate. Thank you for your support.
I'm Tom Rowe in Accra with the WGXC Daily News for Tuesday, July 11th. Go to the WGXC newsroom, WGXC.org, for more information about any of these stories. Raga Justin reports in the Times Union that New York is not yet enrolled in a federal funding opportunity allowing states to expand health care coverage for inmates about to transition back into society. But that should change soon. California recently succeeded in petitioning the federal Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services to use funding from the federal government health care coverage for inmates, the first attempt by any state. New York Department of Health spokesperson Candace Acquaviva said the agency is negotiating the final conditions of a larger expansion of Medicaid coverage with a $13.5 billion request for the federal government. Quote, providing targeted Medicaid services to incarcerated individuals prior to their release is part of the department's strategy to address health disparities and improve health equity, unquote, Acquaviva said in an emailed statement. Around 80% of people released from prison in the United States each year have a substance abuse problem or a chronic medical condition, including mental health issues. Gabriel De La Guarneri, a legal policy director with the Legal Action Center, said, quote, there are tremendous unmet health needs that people have in incarceration, and that has an impact on people's lives. People are dying of overdose. People are dying by suicide, unquote. In addition, Representative Paul Tonko, a New York Democrat, is sponsoring the Reentry Act in Congress to shift cost away from local correctional facilities and increase health care for inmates. Tonko said, quote, so many state and local governments find that these systems of jails and prisons are underinvested. This is about saving lives and doing it with science and evidence-based opportunities, unquote. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Nancy Kern reports for Columbia Green Media that Representative Mark Molinaro listened to farmers worried about climate change, concerned about milk prices, and nervous over reductions in supplemental nutrition assistance program benefits at a listening session at the Columbia County Fairgrounds on July 7th. Molinaro said of the progress on the bill, quote, "The work we're doing is being done in a bipartisan fashion," unquote. Molinaro, a Republican who represents the 19th Congressional District, said that he was raised by a single mother who got food stamps and that he has no plans to make cuts in SNAP in the farm bill. But that doesn't mean he doesn't want to add work limits to benefits. Quote, "We want the government agencies to return to prioritizing helping people get independence and not merely having the state process the check," unquote, Molinaro said. More about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Austin Jefferson reports in the Daily Freeman that Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger called claims of the politicization of the Ulster County Human Rights Commission by three former human rights commissioners after they resigned were, quote, "fundamentally dishonest," unquote. Former commissioners Bruce Ginsburg, Martin Dunkley, and Carl Brown said Metzger's actions, including her appointment of Essie Lewis as interim commissioner and reshaping the commission's membership, made their work difficult. They claim Lewis mishandled a county employee's racial discrimination complaint. Metzger said accusations of executive-level interference were without merit in the case of Bethany Daly, the county employee who the former commissioner said had her case mishandled by Lewis. Metzger also said that, quote, "former Commissioner Wilson's insensitive comments about Asians, Jews, LGBTQIA plus people, single mothers, and other groups are a matter of public record and clearly disqualified him from serving as human rights commissioner," unquote. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman. Read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom, wgxc.org.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Tuesday, July 11th. Local early morning temperatures range from 59 degrees in Tannersville to 63 in Medusa. Regional average soil temperature is 68 degrees. Pollen levels for today will be medium. Yesterday's sunlight gave that a big boost, and it's going to get some more today. After the last moisture rolls out by 9 a.m., the skies clear and temperatures rise to 89 degrees by 5 p.m. Comfortable conditions return around 11 p.m. Dew points will be in the mid-60s, so some people will be okay while others might still be running that AC to keep it comfy. A low of 64 takes us into a hot Wednesday with a rainy afternoon. High of 85. The rain begins around 3 p.m. Overnight, more rain and a low of 67. Thursday, rain, high of 85. Friday, rain, high of 84. Yep, sub pumps and air conditioners are going to be popular this week. Today's tide schedule is low tide at 5:04 a.m., high tide at 10:32 a.m., low tide again at 5:13 p.m., and high tide once again at 11:11 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 71 degrees, and the tide strength will be average. Sunset today will be at 8:18 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:26 a.m. Looking way up, we see there is a geomagnetic storm watch on for tomorrow as we expect a side-swiping Hadouken. X-class flare chances today are at 10%. Plasma winds will be slow at 321 kilometers per second with an average density of 5 protons per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair below 8 megahertz till dark, then fair across the board overnight. There are no chances of aurora tonight. The current sunspot number is 81. And this has been the Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate, who just want to remind you, you can become our personal heroes by heading on over to WGXE.org, clicking on Donate, and becoming one of our sustaining supporters. Those magical people could one day lead to us not having a fun drive.
If it's not De La Slow, then it's not WRMS. We're cats in control, twisting and tuning until you're perfectly content. Special cat call goes out to the suckers at the donut shop. Thanks for serving it to me. Dark, hot, and no caffeine. Snuggle tight and hang loose, boys. It's time to groove to a De La Slow move on WRMS.
from the 2023 A Small Light limited series soundtrack. That was Kamisi Washington with Cheryl on WGXC.
Some one-time grant funding has made the difference between renters in rural New York having a safe place to live or having to move. The McNeil Park Apartments in Copenhagen is an income-based complex for seniors and adults with disabilities. When it was purchased in 2020 by the Copenhagen Happy Acres Housing Fund, McNeil Park was in a state of disrepair. But Snowbelt Housing Company, which manages the complex, applied for a COVID-19 community development block grant. Snowbelt Executive Director Jalen Heems describes what would have happened had the grant not come through.
We would have done the minimal repairs, but eventually, if the roof deteriorated anymore and it became a health and safety hazard, like code could have come in theoretically and made us displace those tenants to another location, or they could have condemned it until somebody could make the repairs.
With the units now in better condition, they're helping to relieve New York's rural affordable housing shortage. A Rural Housing Coalition of New York report finds rural counties in the state have more than 2 million housing units, while their urban counterparts have around three times that amount. Heems notes the grant has also helped keep repair costs down, since major repairs can be made right away. Regular inspections are done to catch repair needs as they happen, and with the apartments looking better than they have in years, she says residents truly feel at home.
It really feels like home. A lot of them have purchased their own plants and stuff for the apartment, like they're really trying to keep up with it. They're using the community rooms again.
The hope is that grants like this can provide housing to stunt the growing national trend of homelessness. The National Alliance to End Homelessness says since 2017, the number of people without permanent shelter has increased 6%. I'm Edwin J. Vieira, New York News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. We have another U.S. Supreme Court case to put on your radar, one which could further erode protections against racial gerrymandering by anti-voter state legislatures. Expect to see Alexander versus South Carolina Conference of the NAACP on next year's docket. A 3-judge federal panel found in 2021 that a congressional voting district was gerrymandered to favor Republicans, partisan gerrymandering, which the U.S. Supreme Court said in a 2019 decision it would leave to the state courts. Vox reports that to accomplish this partisan gerrymander, it moved 79% of black voters in South Carolina's first congressional district into a nearby district, making the first district a safe Republican district. The federal panel ruled that the move violated the Equal Protections Clause of the 14th Amendment. Because the current high court has not been friendly to fair redistricting or upholding the 1965 Voting Rights Act, democracy advocates are concerned that the South Carolina case could further erode laws designed to provide equal representation of black Americans and other minority groups. If the court finds that the primary motivation was partisan gerrymandering, not racial gerrymandering, it creates a loophole that anti-democracy legislatures could exploit and get away with. Expect this case to be on the SCOTUS docket in next year's term. We have links to articles and the Federal Circuit Court panel's decision at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
If you like music that's off the beaten path and often off the beat, then tune in to Overlooked, the second and fourth Tuesday of the month, just after the noon news. You'll hear underplayed and overlooked music of all genres, continents, and omniverses, overlooked on WGXC 90.7 FM.
Next, WGXC's Kieran Riley talks with Jerry Condon about the Golden Rule Veterans for Peace boat. The interview was recorded yesterday, Monday, July 10th, and Condon refers to the boat being in Catskill then and leaving today for Albany. When he says tomorrow, he means today in this interview. Here is Kieran Riley talking to Jerry Condon.
We have Jerry Condon of Veterans for Peace, specifically the Golden Rule Veterans for Peace boat. Right now in waiting. Thank you for your patience, Jerry Condon. This is a most amazing effort and project that is being undertaken. The Golden Rule is a vessel, a boat that has actually been restored in 1958, that set sail in 1958. And this goes back way to the time when they were testing, they're still testing in the world, but in the Marshall Islands, the Bikini Islands, all over the Pacific, nuclear weapons that have absolutely devastated ecosystems and peoples and displaced. And this work continues today. Jerry Condon, welcome to the Monday Afternoon Show. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us. Please tell us, how are you and where are you located?
Hey, Kieran, thank you so much for having me and afternoon show. Well, we're actually pretty close. I'm traveling as the shore support and co-coordinator for the Great Loop Voyage of the historic Golden Rule Peace Boat. And right now we happen to be in Catskill. We just did something rather remarkable today. We took our masts down. They call unstepping the masts. We have two big masts. We have to take them down in order to get through one or more bridges up the Hudson here. So for the next few stops, we're not going to be sailing. We're carrying these big heavy masts on top. But let me go back to 1958 for a second to give your listeners an idea of the history of this boat. Really remarkable story. In 1958, four Quaker peace activists, led by a retired World War II Navy commander, Bert Bigelow, sailed this boat from Los Angeles, headed for the Marshall Islands, 4,000 miles out in the Pacific, with the intention of interfering with U.S. nuclear testing and bringing attention to the problem with all the radiation floating around the globe at the time. Between 1946 and 1958, the U.S. exploded 67 nuclear devices, nuclear bombs, in the Marshall Islands. The people there, Marshallese people, are still suffering the consequences of that with a very high cancer rate. They can't grow their own food, eat their own fish. Many of them have displaced and are living in various communities around the United States now to make these from global warming. So they've really got a double whammy. But at any rate, the intention was to actually sail right into the nuclear test zone. These are people who had been organizing against nuclear weapons and bombs and for quite a while, doing all the kind of things you normally do, public protests, talking to their congressman and the president, writing letters to the editor, etc. And they weren't getting any traction, and the testing was continuing, even though people like the famous Dr. Benjamin Spock, the famous pediatrician, were documenting that the radiation that was floating all around the globe at the time was getting into mother's milk and cow's milk and babies' teeth and bones, and was a huge global health problem. At any rate, the crew got as far as Honolulu, 2,000 miles from their departure point at Los Angeles, and they were arrested. They attempted several times to leave Honolulu to head for the Marshall Islands. They were captured and brought back each time by the U.S. Coast Guard and arrested under a regulation that had been promulgated by the Nuclear Regulatory Agency, which basically said it's illegal to sail into the nuclear test zone. So they were arrested, they were thrown in jail. for 60 days. They were on trial for a while there. And then another boat, the Phoenix of Hiroshima, came into Honolulu Harbor and docked right next to them. And it turns out that, the captain of that boat had been a medical researcher studying the effects of radiation on children in Hiroshima after the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings. So he was, he and his family were so inspired by this, the bravery of this, these Quaker peace activists, that they decided they would sail their boat into the nuclear test zone, which they succeeded in doing. And then that he was arrested, brought back to Honolulu on trial for 2 years. They got a, they brought a lot of worldwide attention. They got a, quite a bit of publicity. They publicized their intentions ahead of time. Their trials were highly visible. There were protests in support of them all around the U.S. and actually around the world. And they succeeded in bringing attention to the problem and also building support for the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, the Partial Test Ban Treaty that was signed in 1963 by President Kennedy and the leaders of the U.K. and the USSR, which banned, made it illegal to test nuclear weapons in the air, in the atmosphere, or underwater, or in space, but allowed it to continue underground. Fast forward, the boat was sold into private hands. Several different families sailed it around the South Pacific and the Caribbean, and somehow or other it ended up in Northern California, on the northern, far Northern California coast in Humboldt Bay, a sunken wreck in 2010. And it had been a derelict boat floating around the bay. Somebody tied it up loosely to a dock. A big gale came along, slammed it into the dock so hard that it got a big hole in the side. It sunk, and it was pulled out, I think, the next day or 2 days later, maybe. And it was such a wreck that people were going to make a bonfire out of it until Veterans for Peace in the area found out about its history and made a decision, really profound decision, to restore the boat. And so for over the next 5 years, there was a really amazing volunteer effort by Veterans for Peace, by Quakers, by wooden boat lovers, to put the boat back together. And it splashed down back into the water in June of 2015. And for the last 8 years, we've been sailing it up and down the West Coast, over to Hawaii and back, and now all around the Great Loop of the Eastern United States, sailing for a nuclear-free world and a peaceful, sustainable future. And we've been on this voyage since September. We started in Minneapolis, went down the Mississippi, through the Ohio River, the Tennessee and Tombigbee Rivers to the Gulf of Mexico, over to Florida. We even made a side trip to Cuba, which we can talk about later. And now we've come all the way up the East Coast. It's an 11,000-mile, 13-month voyage with stops in over 100 cities and multiple events in each city. So it's quite a marathon. It's been extremely well-received. People love the boat. It's a beautiful wooden, classic wooden boat. It's only 34 feet, they love the story, we're helping to really build connections between the anti-nuclear movement and the climate justice movement. So a lot of excitement going on around this boat. We're in, as I said, Catskill right now, and tomorrow we're headed for Albany, where we have several events.
This is absolutely fascinating, and I'm ashamed to say I did not know this was happening until today. I had to make a call to my stepfather from the Veterans for Peace chapter up in Boston. He's involved with the Samantha Smith chapter and the Smedley Butler. John Shushart spoke very highly of you, Jerry Condon.
Oh, well, I know John and of his work, too. We both have a Nicaragua connection as well. We both were involved in bringing attention to the U.S. Contra war there during the 1980s.
Well, that's a very interesting connection. He said that, this work, we're going back to the 50s here, and it's sort of symbolic that this beat-up boat, this old boat from 1958 with just four or so Quakers going out to stop this madness of nuclear testing, to annihilate people and other nations and to just obliterate the ecosystem. Here we are surviving again to bring word, to bring awareness and consciousness to the very reality of nuclear testing and radiation today. And now we're facing something even greater than that, which is the threat of nuclear war, which unfortunately, I do have to say, has not gone away. So I commend this bringing of the consciousness.
Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right about it. The threat of nuclear war is not only not gone away, but many experts believe that it's greater now than it ever has been, including in 1962 during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
And here we are, Jerry. I appreciate it. We could go on forever, but I should let you go at some point. But this Golden Rule, I just got to read off the website here. You can go to the Golden Rule website. It's a project of Veterans for Peace. It says, quote, "We aim to advance Veterans for Peace opposition to nuclear weapons of war and to do so in a dramatic fashion." As we talked about, they restored the boat, the Golden Rule vessel from 1958. And it's sailing once again to show the world that nuclear abolition is possible and that bravery and tenacity can overcome militarism.
Why did you say that? Out there in
Radio Land. Hey, this is Andy, host of Crawl Up from the Fallout with Raven Sings the Blues. The show is a monthly roundup of new music plumbing psych, folk, cosmic Americana, indie, garage, and exploratory titles alongside enough classic gems to hold it all together like glue. You can tune into the show every second Tuesday of the month from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on WGXC 90.7 FM.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
And now joining us once again is retired National Weather Service meteorologist Hugh Johnson for our weekly discussion of weather and climate. Hi, Hugh. This is Bria. Welcome back.
How you doing, Bria?
Doing good. How was your holiday?
It was good. We had a nice 4th of July. We had dinner with friends. I was sad to see that the fireworks were canceled because of that storm, that thunderstorm that moved straight south out of Saratoga, which is a little unusual for a movement like that. I can't say I've seen that very often, but it's been at least 10 years since a fireworks were canceled. I think one time about 10 years ago they were, so it's been a long time. So I guess, you know, sooner or later it was going to happen. We had temperatures were normal. They were in the mid-80s, but it was very, very humid on the 4th of July. Ironically, the 4th of July has been our hottest day ever in recorded history in Albany. In 1911, we hit 104 on the 4th of July that year.
We've had to deal with smoke, then heat, and now excessive rain. I heard this was a once-in-every-1,000-years flood down towards New York City. How did we fare locally?
Not as bad, fortunately, because what happened, Alicia, was the tropical hose. We've talked about this before, the atmospheric river. We could see this coming on the computers, but the hose was just east of the capital region, so we got spared the worst of it. That said, we did have some flooding problems. There were some problems in Troy and other places around the region, but the worst of it was definitely east. Basically, the Deconics up to Vermont is a declared disaster area. And Orange County had the 7 to 9 inches of rain down in near New York City. West Point apparently is a disaster area. But again, in our area, closer to 2 inches. I had, as of 6 o'clock Monday evening, I had 1.85 inches in my bucket. And the airport was pretty similar, around 2 inches. So, again, we did not get the worst of it here, but it was really, really bad just east of the capital region.
Let's talk some terminology. What's the difference between a flood watch and a flood warning? And what's the difference between a flood and a flash flood?
Excellent questions, Bria. All right, a watch is put up generally when antecedent conditions are ripe for or there for the potential for flooding. You look at the atmosphere, the synoptic setup, and what you think is going to happen, how much rain is going to fall, the ground, how wet it is. if the ground isn't wet, you're going to be less likely to put up a flood watch. But the ground was pretty darn wet because we've had quite a bit of rain leading up to this event. So that's a watch is a 50% confidence that we will get some flooding. Think of it that way, at least a 50% confidence. And usually it's put up between 12 hours and up to 2 days before the event, and so people can get a heads up. Now, the warning is when it's actually looking very good or very likely that flooding is actually taking place. That's determined by radar, by observation, and people reporting flooding. If you already have flooding, obviously you probably should already have the warning out, but those are the things, the tools that they use to put out the warnings when it looks like a very good bet. And we right now, it looks like all our warnings are down, but we have plenty of them up this time yesterday. Now, as far as a flash flood and flood, that's a tricky one, but basically a flood is, when you think of a flood, it's when water exceeds bank full on a stream where roads are covered with water, things like that, and even basement flooding and wherever water's not supposed to be, and it is, that's a flood basically to some extent. But flash flooding is a different beast. Flash flooding is a rapid increase in water over a short time, generally involves a current or moving water, and those are the ones that are really threatening. And fortunately, we don't get too many true flash floods around here, but they did happen down in Orange County. One person was killed, several still missing. During Hurricane Irene, we actually had rivers that rose fast enough that it was arguably flash flooding instead of just regular flooding, because rivers usually flood fairly slowly, but not in that case. And also when dams break, we have to put out flash flood warning. That was always a joke at our office. That was your worst nightmare. You know, you're sitting there and there's a breach in the dam. You have to think fast because you might only have a couple of minutes before that surge of water comes down to like the Gilboa Dam. Exactly. There was sometimes occasionally that was fear that was breached. Thankfully, it never was. Comes down Schoharie. It could wipe out the town of Schoharie in minutes. So you have to be quick and really get on it because it's a very quick thing. So flash flooding is quicker, faster moving water, more life-threatening.
So flash is really happening quickly. And again, a watch is there's a strong probability and a warning is, here it comes.
Yep, you got it.
Okay, so looking ahead to our weather forecast coming up for the next week, do we see any patterns changing soon, or are we going to still remain wet, soggy, possibly humid?
Yeah, well, there are going to be some subtle changes, Alicia. That's not going to be exactly the same. We had this deep trough here that was able to push this tropical hose up with a strong disturbance that, you know, affected a lot of moisture right up to like a conveyor belt right up just to the east of the Hudson Valley. That's kind of flattening out that trough. So we're going to at least get, it's not going to be, we're not going to see any really heavy, real heavy excessive rain in the next few days. But that said, we're still going to stay kind of warm and humid. Now, actually, on Monday evening, low pressure was just to our east, and we're actually getting a pretty good westerly breeze, and that's actually taking the dew point down a tick. And I'm looking upstream, I'm seeing dew points in the 50s to around 60. Now, don't get too excited. Probably won't get that low, but we will see dew points dropping off, I think, tomorrow and even in the Wednesday, at least the first part of Wednesday. So we will get a little break from the heat and humidity, or the humidity more than the – actually, temperatures will go up, but the dew humidity will go down next couple of days. And we'll have a few more showers tonight, and they might start off tomorrow with a shower, but after that it should be mainly dry. Wednesday, maybe a late-day shower, but mainly dry as well. So we'll have 2 days to hopefully dry things out. And then, unfortunately, by Thursday, Friday into the weekend – we're going to kind of get these couple of disturbances riding through, and I think a couple of boundaries setting up. So we will have some more showers and thunderstorms, but not like we've had, not to the widespread event that we just had, but it'll be more nuisance stuff. And there could be localized downpours, but it's not going to be a big ball of rain like we had this time. But unfortunately, that's going to be the pattern Thursday through the weekend and maybe even the Monday. Chance of showers and thunderstorms each afternoon, especially warm and muggy. So we're not done with this pattern yet. No, not at all. Just a little break in it.
And one nice thing is that I haven't heard much talk about air quality. I know that the fires are still burning in Canada, but is it that they're not blowing down, the smoke isn't blowing down this way, or the rain's keeping it out of the air?
Well, it's more of the, what you said the first time. The rain helps a little bit, but the trajectory has been, the smoke has been allowed or been forced to stay north of the Canadian border. There's still, unfortunate fires are still going on. They kind of come and go, but they're not going to, they could be going all summer, by the way, but that, I think we're in pretty good shape as far as that goes. Now, that said, next week, the jet stream might actually dip down. We might get a more northwesterly flow, which will help a little bit humidity, but guess what? That's when the smoke might come back. We're talking later next week. I mean, and that's what it looks like in the longer range guidance. So it might actually be a case where, yeah, we'll get a little bit break in the humidity later next week, but we might get some more smoke. Hopefully not, but that's the next chance we'll have for the smoke to return.
So when you say next week, you mean like after the 17th or so?
Yeah, mid-July, mid to late July, yep. Summer's going fast.
Thank you so much for that information. I am getting the signal that we are now out of time. So thank you, Hugh, for joining us and bringing us all that useful information again.
You got it. Enjoy the little respite in humidity next couple of days, folks.
Yeah, and best wishes to our colleagues and others south of here in the Hudson Valley where they're really getting slammed. Thanks, Hugh.
That's true. Bye-bye.
Joined today by Pisa Cora, who's the Climate and Inequality Campaign Director at New York Communities for Change. They put out recently a statement about the recent life-threatening floods that took place, particularly in the lower Hudson Valley, making the point that the devastating storms are, you know, due to the inaction of our elected representatives, and by failing to act at the scale of the crisis, Governor Hochul bears responsibility for the flooding and resulting casualties and destruction that have left millions of New Yorkers vulnerable. So, Pete, apparently those guys at the state capitol are not doing an adequate job responding to climate change?
Yeah, you know, it's not super ideal right now. The climate crisis is accelerating, and we're seeing that all across New York and all across the world with extreme weather events, global heat records being broken. The temperature of the ocean water off Florida is 95 degrees. It's really crazy stuff, the wildfires. So, you know, any individual weather event is not necessarily a result of climate change, but it's like loaded dice. And every year, more pollution loads those dice harder. So New York State is a gigantic polluter, and Governor Hochul has been unwilling so far to stand up to those corporate polluting interests and make them reduce that pollution.
You know, my wife was actually at the state capitol last week of the legislative session, and using the third floor outside the assembly chamber as sort of her meeting point for all the people. And she would say, you know, just looking outside that window, you saw all the haze from the wildfires from Canada, and she would try to get the legislators to pay attention to it, but they did not. What were some of the key things that, you know, really brought some chagrin to New York Communities for Change about Governor Hochul's action during a recent legislative session on climate?
Well, you know, there are so many things that the state needs to be doing, big and small. And because each year is another year of not punching out an agenda like that, we get further behind. So, you know, some very simple, ready-to-go policies include the New York Heat Act, which would save consumers money, utility ratepayers money, and reduce gas use and therefore pollution over time. Right now, everyone on their utility bill subsidizes the build-out of more and more gas infrastructure that locks in pollution that cooks our planet. So it's a very self-defeating cycle. And it's also very expensive because that infrastructure costs a lot of money to produce. And right now, state law effectively obligates its continuance. So what we need to do is move away from the fossil fuel economy and towards a clean energy and energy efficiency economy. And so the New York Heat Act does that. The governor could have put it in her budget, but the big utility companies hate it. And so they oppose it. And so the governor didn't put it in her budget. And another year passed where New Yorkers are paying bigger bills to pollute their own state.
Now, one of the things the governor has put in her budget was the concept of carbon pricing. Not all of us agree with the way she's doing it, but it seemed like when she somehow finally discovered that by putting a price on fossil fuels, it makes fossil fuels more expensive, like at the gas pump or if you're heating your home with gas, you know, she balked and she tried to change the formula to basically reduce the emission levels goals that have been set. Now, New York Communities for Change is a, you know, represents a lot of low-income people. You know, what do you all feel about if you're going to do carbon prices? How do you deal with that regressive nature since low-income people pay a high percentage of their income for energy costs?
Yeah, it's a really serious problem. So, you know, Governor Hochul should not have tried to gut the state's climate and jobs law by changing its math. And she tried to do that in the budget, and that would have been just a disaster for the state by changing the math and reducing the pollution reductions that New York is obligated to make. She is, I think, rightly nervous about imposing some sort of system that might increase costs for working people. And so for us, if to set a cap and invest program, a bottom line is that it needs to put money into working people's pockets. And that's just what a well-designed program will do. It'll save New Yorkers money and it'll raise revenue for more rich people to actually fund the affordability of clean energy across the state. So it could be a great program and the governor has the power to do it. But most recently, she's been delaying on starting the regulatory process that would implement that kind of a program. So the devil's in the details. It really matters a lot how she does it. And we want her to do a strong cap and invest program that raises a lot of money, puts money in working people's pockets, and cuts pollution all over the state while creating hundreds of thousands of good union jobs. That's the outcome we want.
Now, one of the key laws that New York City Communities Change passed in New York City and a mild, smaller version passed at the state level recently is to require in New York City large buildings to basically cut their emissions. And most recently, apparently some of the owners of condos and co-ops, which, you know, can be more moderate income people, have recently gone, oh my goodness, this is going to cost us too much money. How do you deal with those type of situations?
You know, the real estate lobby is New York State and New York City's largest polluter. The largest source of pollution from New York State and New York City is energy use in buildings. But that the good news is that we can reduce that pollution without raising costs through energy efficiency. So think on the simple level, things like LEDs, but on a more complicated level, moving away from fossil fuel boilers and towards heat pumps. And so Local Law 97 in New York City is a landmark law. It's a world-beating law that requires large buildings to reduce their pollution and raise their energy efficiency over the coming decades. And so that creates tens of thousands of jobs, slashing pollution, and also reduces utility bills. But of course, the real estate lobby tried to stop this law from being passed and is spending a lot of money on a fear and misinformation campaign to get people to oppose it and ultimately to get Eric Adams to weaken the law. And so we're pushing Mayor Adams to fully implement and enforce it. And we'd call on Governor Hochul and the state to pass analogous law covering large buildings across New York State.
Now, you mentioned a misinformation campaign by the fossil fuel industry and by quite a few of the utilities. I've always been sort of surprised. The state does put out studies that, you know, documents that we're going to create jobs and save a lot of money in healthcare costs, but they don't seem to actually do much in terms of public education. Is that a mistake on their part?
It's a huge mistake. The state should be spending really serious money to educate people about the climate crisis and how big a problem it is, but how worthwhile the solutions are. When this country took on World War II, the government didn't just leave it to us individually to find our way to take the right action. Rather, it educated people about the necessity of pulling together for a goal together. And that's what New York State should be doing. It should spend a lot of money educating people in order to raise people's level of awareness about the challenge. There is a massive crisis bearing down on us. People are dying all the time. We just saw a series of climate disasters. It's going to get vastly worse in the coming decades unless we all pull together and rapidly reduce pollution. So the state should lead the charge on that. And that should include a massive public education program.
Now, we have about 40 seconds left. You know, people have been critical about the state lawmakers not doing much on climate the last 3 years or so. They claim they were waiting for this state climate plan to come out as part of the climate law CLCPA. That was out this year, but didn't seem to generate the type of level of action needed. In the last 30 seconds, how do we get New York State lawmakers to do what's needed?
Well, you know, this is a democracy, and legislators respond to people power. So people should get involved civically and contact their legislators about important issues that they care about. We're up against big money lobbyists, so overcoming that is hard, but it is doable, and we do it all the time. But to do it at the pace and speed necessary requires more people to pull together.
Thank you very much, Pete Sikora, Climate and Inequality Campaigns Director at New York's Community for Change. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Sitting with me here in the Sanctuary Radio studio is our artist resident, Isidora Fernandez, who is our first Rubin Family Foundation artist resident, working at Nature Lab for a month. Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Hey, thank you for having me.
I should say welcome back, because we spoke last year about a lot of your work at Science for Change.
Yeah, we talk about Odor Collect and the workshops we did on smells.
Yeah, so we're really excited to have you back now as an artist resident. Before we get too far into what you're doing here, who are you? What should we know?
First, that Ipi, that's my real name. And I'm from Chile. But I've been living in Barcelona for 3 years so far, I think, yeah. And I work in a company that's called Science for Change. We do citizen science and science communication, especially science divulgación. That's a word that you don't have in English, but we love.
So what's a rough translation?
To make science, it's to make it vulgar, like common.
Okay.
To make science common to everyone.
So last time we spoke about how there's a lot of commonality between the work that you do there with citizen science and what we're doing here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media, and specifically Nature Lab. So what is the focus of your residency? What's the purpose?
The purpose is to use art as a tool to get more people involved and get the word out of what's happening with the Hudson River, what's happening with your water. So I've been here knowing all the things that you've been testing, like bacteria and microplastic and macroinvertebrates. That's a hard word. Mm-hmm. And lead.
And lead.
Lead. That's another hard word. And these past 2 weeks have been me just getting to know how you do all the things that you do, for me to get a little bit motivated to create stuff with all of this. So we're doing a workshop on all of those things together, mixed. All the things that you test on water, we're going to make it one big workshop using art.
And so you mentioned the Hudson River, but that is a regionally specific waterway. How have you been teaching yourself about the Hudson River to teach other people about the Hudson River?
Yeah, that's been hard, because there's so many layers of information on the Hudson River. There's so much history, and this place is so important in that history. It's so close. And I'm not so familiar with American history. But the things that you're testing can be replied on any river. And that's what I like, because I can take this to Rio Mapocho, that's in Chile. I can take this to El Besós in Barcelona. I can take, because I think that there will be similar problems.
So what are some of the problems that you're finding?
Tons and tons and tons of microplastic. Like, it's amazing how many of them there are. And they're in the tap water, drinking water, in the river, it's really polluted. Also, it's not only microplastic, you can see the plastic. It's also big plastic. So I wanted to play a little bit with that. And also bacteria, that's the one that most, like, was really impactful because it glows. And I love glowy things. So although they're bad, it's their fecal matter.
Yeah, the Enterococcus.
The Enterococcus, yeah. It's so beautiful to see them glow.
I've seen it. And I've seen the youth react to seeing glowing through their microscope. It's really cool.
It's really cool. And you put this UV light on it. It's amazing. So although it shows that something wrong is happening, like there's fecal matter in the Hudson and also in other streams, it's very, very beautiful.
I find a lot of these destructive things are very beautiful.
Yeah.
What does that mean from an art perspective?
It gives you many options because if it's not attractive visually or sound or texturally attractive, people are not going to see it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you make it attractive, they're going to go for it. And then you can explain what that means. So, yeah, that was a really nice discovery to have this blue, really gorgeous blue looking at me like directly. I knew I had to do something with that. So that's a main piece of the workshop.
Yeah, this workshop is July 12th. That's a Wednesday from 2 to 5 p.m. at Nature Lab. If a listener might be interested in attending, what is the workshop focusing on? What will be taking place?
It's called Forensic River because we're making it like a crime scene. Mm-hmm. The river is...
Forensic River.
Yeah, the river is not dead, but we're making it appear like it's dead and we have to find who's to blame. But we're not focusing on who's to blame, but who to save. So we're trying to save the macroinvertebrates. We're trying to save the plants on the river. We're trying to save us. So we're making a case. And we have all this evidence and we have to make strong arguments with people. So if you're an opinionated person, you should come.
Okay. And in addition to the opinionated people, who else might be attracted to this workshop?
Really everyone, because we're not making it hard. That's my job, to make it easy. And every